Good morning. Good morning, everyone. This is a work session of the North Dakota Public Service Commission. Am I talking too loud? These are different mics than we're used to. Am I too close?
Nope, you're fine.
Okay. So this is a work session of North Dakota Public Service Commission. I'm Randy Christman, joined by fellow decision makers in this case, Commissioner Sherry Haugen Hoffert and Judge Tim Dawson. And I probably will continue to explain because our process isn't familiar to a lot of people who have expressed interest in this case over the course of over a year. You know, we've had hearings all over the state. I don't know how many hearings we've had, probably 10 or something, whatever the number, and took public comment until everyone was done at all of them. A work session is different in that because we're a government agency, you know, our thoughts on the case, we can't go back and I can't call Tim or Sherry and say like, well, what do you think of this aspect? You know, that would be an open records violation. So these are our opportunities to discuss the case and see where everybody is at and in many instances seek advice from our staff and legal counsel. So we've had those hearings. We did one of these, was it a week ago today, I believe, and went through some kind of areas of that we heard a lot about in the hearing process. Today, we'll continue on with that. A couple of the ones that, as I look through my notes from all those hearings and highlights that I've done on, and by the way, when we get filings, a filing might be a paragraph on a page, or it might be hundreds of pages, and it still is considered a docket. I believe we have more dockets in this case than any case the PSC's ever had, at least in any kind of recent memory. And I don't know where we're at, 700, 800 and some. But when I go through and I'm looking at things that I've highlighted and flagged in there or notes from our hearings, especially not so much in the dockets. And by the way, the dockets come from both the company as well as the interveners. So, but especially in my notes from hearings, a lot of comments that we received had to do with either the safety compliance of the pipeline or the general policy of sequestering CO2. And I want to make sure I'm understanding it the same as the others, and like so hopefully we're all on the same page, or if not, that we've at least talked it through and understand divergent views. But my understanding on the policy sequest, the policy part of it, I mean, that to me, in years of participating and watching government, that the policymakers are essentially the legislators and state legislators as well as the federal Congress, to some extent the president and the governor, in that they're very influential from their bully pulpit, if you will, but we carry out the policy. And so there's a whole lot of government policies that I don't like, but we follow them because it's the law of the land. And so I don't know that we really have anything that we could or should do here as far as, you know, upending federal policy. And actually, it's not just a policy that allows CO2 sequestration, there's an incentive to encourage it. And I don't think there's anything that we can do about that. And on safety compliance, I think we have a lot more authority on power lines and things such as that. But my understanding is on pipelines that fall under PHMSA, which is, for those that aren't familiar with our process, the pipelines Hazardous Safety Materials Administration, something like that. It's a federal agency that deals with pipe, like liquid and gas pipelines, that they set the safety standards, and the states really don't make them more or less strict. So I guess I open it up to staff or my fellow decision makers. Does anyone view these things differently, that we need more information or discussion?
No, I think you summarized it very well, Chair Crispin, as far as those two areas and where the jurisdiction lies.
I agree as well. It is we aren't policymakers. We have to follow the law, and so when it comes to policy for carbon dioxide sequestration, we don't have any authority there. And as for safety, we definitely don't have any authority over what PHMSA does.
Yeah. Mr. Pelham or Mr. Shook, did anything to add or correct to that on those topics?
No, I think that was a good summary. I don't have any. I think that's in keeping with how we've viewed these things historically in other cases.
Okay. I don't have anything to add. Thank you.
Okay, and then eminent domain has been something that people have fought over for many, many decades, and the law has been changed a lot on it. But that's another one that we heard a fair amount of public testimony on. And you want to just explain that process with these common carriers? I think basically, I understand the common carriers file something with us, so it looks like we're involved, but we are just the place where something gets filed and someone can look to see whether they filed. And then once they file, they are a common carrier until a court would say that they're either not going to operate as a common carrier, or if they're operational, that they're not meeting the common carrier guidelines. Or explain that to us, please.
Thanks, Commissioner. The common carrier definition is found in Title 49. It's Chapter 49-19. There's a definition of common pipeline carriers at 49-19-01. And then there is a statute titled When Pipeline Carrier May Exercise Right of Eminent Domain. And that's found at Century Code 49-19-12. And I'll just read a short portion of it. Every common pipeline carrier which shall have filed with the commission its acceptance of the provisions of this chapter has, subject to Chapter 32-15, which is the eminent domain statute chapter, the right and power of eminent domain, in the exercise of which it may enter upon and condemn the land, right-of-way, easement, property of any person necessary for the construction, maintenance, or authorization of its pipeline. And in this particular instance, at PU-22-260, case number PU-22-260, Subic Carbon Solutions has filed its acceptance of the provisions of North Dakota Century Code Section 49-19-12. And it has agreed to follow the statutes as provided by law. So in this instance, Summit Carbon Solutions is a common pipeline carrier and is entitled to seek eminent domain under Chapter 32-15. And that process is not anything that the commission has anything to do with. That is filed in district court, and there is procedures and processes in place for companies seeking to condemn under the eminent domain statutes. Just very briefly, in the Malloy decision, which was recently appealed to the North Dakota Supreme Court, and SCS Carbon Transport LLC versus Malloy, that had to do with a challenge to the ability for Summit to survey, to do preliminary surveys for the pipeline route. And it was challenged by many landowners, not just Malloy. There's a whole list of landowners that challenged that. The district court decision was decided by Judge Narum, and in his order at the district court level, he determined that Summit was a common pipeline carrier. And of note, and the process for an appeal is, if you don't appeal a decision from a lower court, then effectively the Supreme Court or reviewing appellate court isn't going to review that determination. In the Malloy decision from the North Dakota Supreme Court, there's a footnote. It's footnote one in that decision, and it states, landowners have not challenged on appeal that Summit meets the requirement of a condemning authority. In other words, they haven't. The landowners in the Malloy decision didn't challenge that Summit was in fact a common pipeline carrier entitled to at least seek condemnation under 32-15. So summed up, Commissioner, the processes for eminent domain are outside the jurisdiction of this commission, aside from the perfunctory, rather, in some respects, filing of a acceptance of the requirements to follow the statutes, which has been done in this case.
And so one of the things that I think is confusing, but I'm pretty sure I understand it correctly. And I'm going to compare it to what I talked about previously with the PHMSA safety standards, where that's a federal law that says essentially PHMSA will set safety standards on these jurisdictional pipelines. Here, how this whole business works with eminent domain and common carrier status, I think that's a state statute. So when people read that a pipeline, you know, a court said it's not a common carrier in some state, that doesn't mean it's not legally a common carrier in a different state. Or the same with it, how you exactly get eminent domain authority, that can be different in the various states, correct?
It absolutely is different in different states. And that's our framework of government in the United States, federal law, state law, and states are entitled and do enact varying degrees of laws on varying degrees of topics. And that is very much true, Commissioner. So our statute has to be interpreted as to the other states, as to their eminent domain statutes, as to application to North Dakota. In my opinion, there is no application, period.
Awesome. Anything else?
You're very thorough. I have nothing to add.
Commissioner Haugenhofer?
No, I think you summarized it up again very well. Nothing to add.
Well, we're cruising then. In an unrelated case, there, not even a pipeline case, there were dust issues. And I am seeking a refresher without going through thousands and thousands of pages of filings. Victor, you're very good at keeping track of these things and finding them. Can you tell me where we're at as far as what the company is committed to, as far as dust suppression? Because like I say, in a different siting case. These dust issues can be huge things for people that actually live out there along the way. And where are we at with dust suppression?
Sure. So in Appendix 12 of the original application, the company submitted a dust control plan. The plan, I will say, isn't overly prescriptive or specific. It kind of refers to mitigative measures as recommended by the North Dakota Department of Environmental Quality, which I did review. They do have a lot of good suggestions, but they're kind of suggestions of a method to stay within their tolerance level, for lack of a better term. They have some specific fugitive emissions limitations, and it's a standard that I'm not terribly familiar with, but they do have a standard nonetheless. And as a method or methods to avoid becoming in violation of that, they recommend things such as watering. I'm going to pull up that specific statute here. So watering, dust, and I don't even know how to pronounce this word properly, palliatives, dust palliatives, detouring, paving, closure, speed control, or other means such as surface treatment with penetration chemicals, or methods of equal or greater effectiveness in reducing the air contamination produced. So all that is to say, there are recommendations out there that the company did list out in their dust control plan. The one area that I had a little bit of concern about is they seem to focus more on residential or farmsteads with their areas of particular dust control. Based on the other electrical cases you mentioned, I think it would be more appropriate if we could expand that out to be near ag fields such as hayland or grazing land. Those are some pretty large concern areas for us. So I guess we could do that a couple of ways. The commission can just order that change. The company can voluntarily submit an amended dust control plan that we could adopt or include as part of the order. But that would be, I guess, my summation of the dust control issue.
And I guess, you know, some of it's just my own background. I do think it is very important that companies understand that it's more than just the farmstead that happens to be close to a gravel road where their trucks are going back and forth all day on. Cattle do not have a real refined palate, and they're not going to avoid grazing somewhere where they want to graze just because the grass is terribly dusty. And same with the hay that gets distributed to them in the wintertime. And grass pneumonia is a real thing, and dust is a significant factor in it. And so I do think it is very vital in areas with a lot of traffic that project developers practice good dust suppression tactics where the traffic is heavy and where it's problematic. But that's something that actually we didn't get a lot of testimony on. So thoughts on that? Is everyone just satisfied with what the company filed? Do you want to be a little more precise or put some kind of emphasis on project-wide or something like that?
There was some discussion on from the public on livestock, some concerns there, and also I can't say for certain if the commissioner, Doug Goring, referenced that. Do you remember if he did? But I guess if they have a mitigation plan and we're looking for some expansion, does it hurt us to get that up front, that they're taking a good look at it and that they have steps in place? Because we're going to ask for it eventually. So I think if they look at it and work on it now and submit it to us, I think there's benefit to that.
Well, do we need them to file something, or do we just, if this would go forward and be approved, that it's just a bit part of the order that the dust suppression.
I'm fine with that.
Part of the project. I don't know really how best to do it.
Sure. It's probably simplest.
What's already been filed there.
It's probably simplest for us if the company would file an amended dust control plan. And then we can simply list that out in the order as something the company is committed to. Rather, alternatively, and this is fine as well, just within our order, we can address that, you know, the company submitted this plan, we find it acceptable except for these things, which we would want additional focus on this, that, and the other thing. I mean, we can come up with that specific language, but we could order that as well.
You know, we had our previous ruling that the PSC supersedes county ordinances on zoning. And one exception to that is road use agreements. And the road use agreement definition includes dust control measures. So is this in some way a local issue too? I mean, who would know better about the dust and where it's going to be?
It absolutely could be.
I'm throwing that. I don't know what we historically do, the PSC historically does for dust mitigation. And there is a benefit for us to set a standard so that there isn't all this varying standard out there. But is this typical?
Yes and no. So having a dust control plan is pretty typical for a siting case. In another electrical, it's a wind farm case, there was a dust control plan that involved some other things than what we're talking about here, a speed limit, for example, and some watering efforts. The implementation of those didn't work out quite so well, and we had to do quite a bit of follow-up and work with the company to get it to what the locals would consider acceptable. But we're in a similar kind of a local versus our jurisdiction on some of that as well, because to the point, some of those road use agreements do have dust mitigation measures that the company must employ. So I don't think I have a real nice, perfect, clean answer for you of whether it's our jurisdiction or theirs. But I think at a minimum, we can start out with, you know, this plan that they've submitted, it's not specific. It says we will do these things and those things. It doesn't say we're going to have 9 water trucks running all the time. It just says that they will have watering trucks where necessary. So it's a good start to a plan. And to your point, if the road use agreement with a particular county requires, you know, 2 trucks or 4 trucks, something along those lines, that would be the best place for those kind of detail, rather than us being prescriptive, where maybe having us saying you have to have 30 water trucks throughout the state or 100 water trucks may not be appropriate. Maybe one county needs 10 and the other county needs 2. It just kind of depends.
And I think it's pretty unpredictable, you know, depending on where a laydown yard gets put or something like that, and where they're hauling pipe from. You could have a township or a county with very little impact from the actual siting of the pipeline that gets lots of traffic on some rural road.
Yep.
And if they haven't been in energy development before, they might not even realize what's coming their way. And so I think we need to be a little bit the overseer of that. And so I guess I just hope that it's understood either through our order or through a filing that it's not just the house that's close to the road, that land is being used for a valuable purpose, and we can't have a continual dust storm covering it.
So have we kind of came to a consensus if we're just going to work with it through the order or request any additional information. What I hear you say is the dust mitigation suppression will be addressed through the order and not seek any additional filing.
Well, I guess here's my thought. You guys tell me if you like a different avenue or if there's a better legal approach to it, but my thought is we'll see if the company files anything now and clarifies some of these things, and if not, then we can address it in the order if we choose to.
I would just comment just generally. We seem to be talking in somewhat generalities. I mean, I think any specific items should be detailed, because otherwise, in fairness, I mean, what is it that we're asking? I don't know, Victor, if you have any specifics that, you know, you've come up with or anything like that. Otherwise, it just, you know, well, can you provide something more? And so, well, what is going to be enough? What's going to satisfy the commission? So that's my only general comment.
So in section 2.3 of their dust control plan, this is one of the areas. I know this is referenced elsewhere as well. And I was just noticing something. So the contractor will take appropriate precautions to prevent fugitive emissions caused by sandblasting from reaching any residence or public building. Curtains of suitable material will be placed if necessary to prevent windblown particles from sandblasting operation reaching residences, roads, and public buildings. That's kind of one of the areas that stuck out to me, is it seems like we're focusing on buildings and residences rather than ag fields. And granted, that was specific to sandblasting, but I know elsewhere in here there were references to residences. I'm just not finding it as I'm trying to thumb through here, but that would be the specific areas that I would expect if the company was going to make an amended filing of the dust control plan to amend it to include ag fields, to include haylands and grazing areas.
I just don't want to be so prescriptive to be getting into setting numbers of water trucks or how many thousand gallons of water per mile or any of that kind of stuff. It seems to me things can, even at the residences, and to me this is such a common misunderstanding that it's not just the residences that matter, but we've never had to define what the parameters are of controlling dust around the residences. You know, reasonableness has prevailed for all these years. And for me personally, the big point here is just understanding that excessive dust has adverse impact on these ag producers, on their other land too, and just besides where they live. And so really just an understanding that there's going to be dust suppression efforts where large amounts of dust are being created. I hope it doesn't have to be a lot more detailed than that. There's lots of things in cases where we end up through our inspectors, and just reasonableness has to prevail. You know, weed control is one of them. I've spent a lot of time in North Dakota on back roads and such, and things like Canada thistle are kind of all over. And we don't say that there can't ever be another stock of Canada thistle on a right-of-way somewhere, but we also don't want them to never clean their equipment and just plow through it and go mile after mile spreading it either. And so we do have them follow weed management plans, and some weeds like that are very prevalent you know there will be some, but you do your best to not spread it. And hopefully here too, yes, there's going to be some dust, but hopefully that doesn't mean just unlimited amounts of dust either.
I guess that from my perspective, I think that would be appropriate, as narrow or as specific as I think we need to get with this plan. Largely it is a good plan. They have the right focus, except if we can see those couple amendments to your point to make sure we're considering those other ag fields.
I concur with the amendment in those areas. Yep.
You had mentioned the Department of Environmental Quality. Are there standards? Are we tying into those some way? And are those specific in any way? Or are they broad like our standards as well?
They're pretty broad. I mean, they do have some sort of, it's a particulate emissions standard that I'm not familiar with how they come up with this thing. Beyond that specific limitation, they're kind of general recommendations. And by way of the company's dust control plan, they reference to those standards, limitations, and recommendations, which I think is entirely appropriate.
And so if you're a person, a landowner out in the country somewhere, and you think there's too much dust, and you want to call somebody in state government, who do you call? Or do you call the company?
Well, that's always, I mean, so when we have siting cases, that's always our initial preferences for if the landowner has an issue, for them to raise it with the company, and hopefully they can work it out, rather than us being a middleman or somebody else being a middleman. But on occasion, that doesn't happen in a satisfactory manner. So I don't think I have a definitive answer. I mean, we certainly have had folks reach out to us with dust control issues. We'll make attempts to be that middleman. And in some cases, you know, if we have specific things that we can refer to from our orders, you know, kind of rely upon that as our authority that we're relying upon. But it kind of depends, you know, just to the all of the things we've been talking about here. I mean, some of the road use agreements might specify that. So maybe the county is the appropriate place, but we don't know necessarily if that's the case. And quite honestly, the landowner may not know that either. So that's as clear as I have an answer on that one.
I agree with what Randy had said earlier. So, but I was just curious because sometimes people just, you know, it's where the rubber hits the road sometimes. It's not, nobody living out there is going to read the application. So they're going to pick up their phone.
Yes.
Then there were a couple of the factors out of 4922.1, a couple of the 11 factors we were going to go over.
Yes.
And I know you have some statistics on some of those things.
So, let's start with concerns raised by other agencies. So a few of them specifically. So, you know, there's a huge list of agencies that must be notified of siting applications. Some of them choose to engage and file comments or concerns, and many do not. In this case, we did receive letters from the Department of Environmental Quality that didn't raise any particular concerns to us. They had some suggestions on how the company can minimize impacts, but they largely didn't have any concerns.
That was DEQ, did you say?
Correct.
Department of Environmental Quality.
The North Dakota Geological Survey actually filed two separate letters in this case. One, 2023, I forget what month exactly, but early that year they filed the concerns that the company wasn't using their North Dakota specific maps for geologically unstable areas. So it's my understanding, subsequent to that letter, the company reached out, received their maps, and was utilizing those to identify geologically unstable areas. Subsequently, earlier this year, the North Dakota Geological Survey submitted a letter to us saying they no longer have concerns that the company is using the right map. They don't get prescriptive in what they say is okay to do within a geologically unstable area. They just want to make sure you're looking at the right maps to identify those within North Dakota. So the North Dakota Geological Survey was happy.
Neither of those two agencies has any objections filed that we're working through yet.
Correct.
Okay.
Third agency that we work with quite extensively and often is the State Historical Preservation Office. Within the docket, there are two letters from what we refer to as SHPO, the State Historical Preservation Office. The first letter was, I believe that was dated again in 2023. In relation to volume one, they had said it wasn't in an acceptable format for them to utilize. So they essentially kind of rejected it.
And just when you say volume one, you're talking about like a filing, this filing on this topic being a volume, and then another filing on another topic being a volume. You're not talking about a volume of CO2 going through a pipeline. You're talking about paper filings, right?
Correct. Okay. Correct. Yeah. I did kind of clarify that with SHPO on this one. So when the first volume of survey information that they received was initially in an incorrect format. So they kicked it back to the company. The next letter that we have within the docket currently from SHPO is in relation to the second volume they received, or volume two, which they said is in an acceptable format. They did not sign off that there are no significant properties affected, but they did say it's an acceptable format and they're working through it. I did reach out to the SHPO to see if they had a similar letter for volume one, since I wasn't able to find one within the docket. They do have one. It's not within the docket in this case, so we can make sure that gets filed. So the company resubmitted volume one in an acceptable format to them, and they are working through that volume as well. That discussion, they also anticipate additional volumes coming in. So the volume one I keep referring to, I believe, was surveys that were conducted in 2022 or before. Volume two would have been 2023 surveys. We would anticipate volume three to be 2024 surveys, and then anything beyond that to be part of volume four. I would expect similar letters from SHPO for each of those, with the ultimate goal of SHPO, once they have an opportunity to review all of the filings, they will typically issue a letter saying, we've reviewed everything within your submission, and we concur with no significant sites impacted, as provided you use the mitigation efforts that you specified within your reports. And usually that involves, you know, there's going to be cultural resources, various types and sizes, and they'll usually have some sort of a buffer around those so that they're not disturbed. And that's usually the mitigation that we'll see.
Okay. So in previous siting history of power lines, pipelines, conversion generation facilities, a lot of those siting orders that grant approvals have the approval pending SHPO final approval, correct?
Correct.
Where like,
it will be
this project has PSC certification, but this area can't be constructed until they get SHPO approval, right? That's kind of the normal order of things, right?
Correct. In prior orders, such as what you're referencing, we would say something akin to, we're approving this project conditioned upon you receiving and filing with the commission an acceptance letter from SHPO for any area that you intend to construct. So essentially you cannot construct in any area that you haven't received and filed a SHPO concurrence letter for.
Okay.
I'm going to seek clarification. So you reference volume 1, 2, 3, based on the year. We have land that has not been surveyed yet. So do we anticipate having like a volume 4, 5 once each parcel is surveyed? How's that with the remaining, let me summarize it, with the remaining land that needs to be surveyed, do you anticipate receiving a volume? SHPL will receive a volume.
Yes, I don't know when that would happen. I guess it's pretty typical, you know, so during the summer season in North Dakota, when all of the surveyors go out and do their survey work, after they've done their survey, it takes some time for them to prepare a report, and then they would submit to SHPL. So I would assume, you know, fall, winter is when those reports are submitted to the SHPL. So I would anticipate at least four total volumes being submitted to SHPL with this project. I mean, there could be five. It's hard for me to say. I mean, the company could certainly identify that. But again, if we were to do what we were just kind of referencing, we would leave it both specific and generic enough to say, you may not construct on any parcel without having a SHPL concurrence letter received and filed. But yeah, let's.
Thank you for that clarification.
Okay, that's SHPL then?
Yep, that's SHPL. Other agencies, so.
And just for guests, because Victor said it at the beginning, but we've used it so much and so long now, SHPL is a State Historic Preservation Office.
North Dakota Game and Fish doesn't always comment on our cases. It's typically if they have a particular concern, they will. I know they've been consulted in this case. You know, the company has submitted a couple of different filings on agency consultations that are extensive. I think the most recent one is 33 pages long of line items of communications they've had with various agencies. From what I was able to find, I could not find a letter from the North Dakota Game and Fish Department, which isn't particularly concerning, but it's one that a lot of cases they will file something, but not certainly not all. One other agency I do believe I saw.
Game and Fish is an active participant in citing projects. They let us know when they view something as adverse.
Yes. Another kind of typical agency is the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. They, I do believe, had a letter filed within this case, and U.S. Fish and Wildlife typically doesn't get overly prescriptive or specific. They reference a lot of, you know, here's how you get this permit and that permit, and here's all of the mitigation measures that we want you to make sure that you're following. So U.S. Fish and Wildlife didn't have anything specific or concerning.
And I think there was confusion a year ago when we denied this project. And I still get these two things kind of mixed up sometimes between wildlife management areas and wildlife protection areas and game management areas. And which really we had jurisdiction over and which maybe we didn't and took it. But those were kind of a mix between the result of feedback from Game and Fish and U.S. Fish and Wildlife, correct? But anyway, those, whichever they were or whichever they are, have been resolved now by either boring underneath it so as not to disturb the soil or going around them, right?
Correct. So, the distinction, yeah, was wildlife protection areas or game management areas. And then the areas in question were waterfowl production areas. So there's a number of those in kind of the southern part of North Dakota, not just the southern part, but primarily in the southern part. There's more of those. And We had initially listed those out as a concern under the game management areas. There's some dispute over whether or not those really belong in that category, but regardless, the company agreed to bore or avoid those entirely, which would minimize, if not eliminate, any impact to them. So at that point, we really don't need to worry quite so much about whether they are game management areas, wildlife protection areas, or none of those.
Okay.
Critical habitat. So one area of critical habitat that's noteworthy in here is for the piping plover, which is primarily on the sandbars on the Missouri River. It's a pretty typical one that we see with linear projects, whether it be a pipeline or a power line. In this instance, the company will be boring underneath the Missouri River, which would eliminate any impact to that habitat. So the impact is minimized, essentially. It's pretty common type of method we see in these cases to avoid them. Outside of critical habitat, we had quite a bit of back and forth about 500-foot setbacks. So within our exclusion and avoidance areas, 500 feet from any residence or business. Initially, there was listed up to potentially 8 of those, and then it changed to other numbers. But the most recent information was there's one residence within 500 feet, and they did obtain a waiver from that resident.
And that waiver, have I just heard that enough times, or do I think I remember seeing it? That was filed with us, right? That's in our record.
I believe it is. I didn't, of all the papers I pulled, I didn't pull that piece of paper, but if we add that to the order, we'll make sure that we have it in the case somewhere.
Okay.
It was in our order on August 4th
Excuse me. It was in our initial order, number 29, that we have received the waiver for one of the residents. Okay. So it's been addressed.
There you go. Just kind of double checking my list. So one other thing I do on these kind of exclusion and avoidance areas is I have myself a little checklist that I go through with every siting application we do. And anything that doesn't clearly say that there is no impact to them, I kind of do a little further investigation. And basically, I've done that for every single one of our exclusion and avoidance areas because we get specific on these. I mean, we're talking, you know, parks, landmarks, historic districts, forests, all kinds of things. So there was a number of things that I had concerns with initially, but once I read all the filings, some of them actually I did ask some questions at the hearing to confirm, but I don't have any remaining concerns for any of those exclusion or avoidance areas. Yeah.
Do you have that section of law where the exclusion and avoidance areas are?
I do. One of these piles of paperwork. Well, it's actually not law. It's our rules. 69. Rules. I think it's 690608. So North Dakota Administrative Code 69-06-06-08. And there's a distinction so that section covers both electrical and pipeline, and it also covers sites and corridors. So it's, if someone is reviewing that section, it's very important to look at the heading of the section you're reviewing to make sure it's appropriate for this particular kind of case, because there's some provisions that apply to sites, others that apply to corridors.
Yeah. But so it was North Dakota administrators really clarifying here, with getting in a tongue twister. Huh? It's North Dakota Administrative Code 69-06-06-08.
No, 69-06. Wow, I can't say that. 69-06-08.
Oh, okay. Now that we've clarified that so smoothly. That kind of covers the things that I had felt were ripe for discussion. Did you have anything else today?
There is one. It's open, but it's not open. So much earlier this year, there was a decision by the commission for the trade secret protection status of the dispersion and plume modeling. There was a filing by Burleigh County in May requesting the commission to reconsider that decision.
So I guess I've been doing this the longest of the three of us, and clarify for this commission has for a lot of years been very cautious about releasing things like information like this where protection is sought. Because of the potential for it kind of opening the door for what someone might want to do to impose a terrorist action. Is that your memory too, and our record on it? I don't recall that we have ever released the safety information, the parts of it where protection was sought.
For safety information specifically, that is correct. So I will say that there's two kinds of typical types of information that's requested for trade secret status. One is safety related information. The other would be financial related information. That one's most typical in our economic regulation area. It's on occasion within a citing case, we might get something like that, but most typically in a citing case, it is safety information and on occasion, location information as well for the specific location of a pipeline. GIS information specifically is always protected. I don't recall an instance where any of that safety related information, we have disagreed with the request and ultimately denied it. But yes, that's very typical for us to grant trade secret protection status for something, particularly safety related.
Well, to this point, I have not been persuaded that we should be releasing that. I think it is. You know, if we're going to do that, I don't know why one company would be different than others. And to me, we could just be really opening up opportunities for terrorists to, you know, potentially do a lot of damage to the people in North Dakota. It's unrelated to this because it was perfectly obvious things, but I mean, we've just had a federal prosecution of a guy who, in I think multiple states, but certainly in North Dakota, was, you know, sitting out on the road shooting up transformers or substations. And in that case, I don't know that it harmed anyone as far as, you know, it's not like it caused an explosion and someone was killed or something, like tampering with pipeline valves or things like that can. But it's certainly exposed the ratepayers of those companies to more money, because the company is going to have to recover the costs of replacing all that equipment that he destroyed. And so this plume modeling, I think, is something that is best left protected. The safety people that need it have access to it. Correct me if I'm wrong, but I haven't changed my mind about our previous decision.
When you talk about the safety, the appropriate people, I think we need to bring them back to PHMSA, who oversees the pipeline and the safety, that they have the oversight. That's where the oversight of the safety goes, in which they would have to comply with.
Absolutely.
Yep.
I was thinking about the cultural and archaeological resources that we keep secret as well. And we do that because people use that information. They go out and they steal those resources that are out there. And although a terrorist act is probably unlikely, you would hate to be the cause of it by releasing too much information. And it seems a reasonable decision to keep that trade secret.
Okay. One other item just to touch on briefly. So the one open item from our last work session was around liability insurance. We did receive a filing from the company on that late Friday afternoon. I'd like to get a little bit additional clarification from the company before kind of bringing that back up in a discussion. So we can kind of revisit that at the next work session if everyone's okay with that.
Okay. That's all I have for today. Anything for anyone else?
I have nothing to add.
Did you want to take on the difficult task of scheduling? We've had some terrible times scheduling our other related meetings of late. Fall is the time when we get a lot of utility filings, and I'm talking about like the distribution utilities that file with us and such, and dates and times have been tough to come by. But Victor, I kind of fed you my available days. Have you been able to survey people a little bit and have any recommendations?
Yes. Since the last meeting, I've been trying to work with all of you to get some available days and times. And it to your point, it's been very challenging. Scheduling outside of having my fingernails removed by the pliers is my next favorite thing. So the next couple of weeks are pretty tough. We have some hearings going on, and some of you have some out-of-state commitments. So from all of the information I've compiled, the earliest possible date for our next work session isn't until October 7th. And specifically would be sometime that morning.
What day of the week is that?
Monday.
I didn't bring my calendar with me.
Monday, but October 7th. I'm available in the morning.
And That was one of the ones we discussed. That was open on mine when we were talking about some various dates, correct?
Yes.
Okay, so then I'm available too. I haven't scheduled anything else since then.
Okay.
That one work for you?
Works well for me.
Is there a preference on start time?
I would prefer 8 to 10.
8 to 10?
Yep.
It's sometimes tough if things, because these aren't our rooms, and if things don't get placed exactly as we want them, it makes it really challenging on our staff then to get everything reset on the day when we actually have the room and do it by 8. Could we do it like at 9, or are you running into a deadline on the other end?
Well, he asked for a preference, so I gave it. So I'm flexible in that. To make it easy for staff and others, I'm open for the AM. I can move something around.
Sure. 9 would be preferable for us, because yeah, we do have to kind of move things around a little bit and do some testing of the systems to make sure we can hook up correctly. Because yeah, to your point, especially when we have a Monday meeting, they don't set it up until sometime the weekend before. So we're hitting it as soon as we get in on Monday morning. So 9 would be preferable, but we can make work whatever you all need.
Anytime in the morning's fine with me.
So staff, whatever you prefer.
And Zach, we need you too.
I'm flexible.
And so let me just say, commissioners, I've got one or two more kind of general areas that I'm researching that I want to talk about. And there's a potential that could be our last work session, maybe. And so if you have some other things, it's not like we can talk about them in the hallway. So make sure that Victor knows, so that if it is possible, if research is done and we're ready, that we can take it up then. Okay, with that, this work session is concluded. Thank you.